5. Daokis and the Taliban. Local governance, bottom-up state formation, and the rule of law in counterinsurgency. Author's note. This chapter is an edited version of the 2009 Wallace Worth Memorial Lecture, University of New South Wales, Sydney, September 2, 2009. This annual public lecture in honor of the university's former chancellor, Wallace Worth, first delivered in 1964, is a major event of the university's calendar. In 2009, the lecture was also the keynote address for the symposium Catalyzing the Rule of Law in Afghanistan, Challenges and Opportunities, co-sponsored by the university's Center for Interdisciplinary Studies of Law and the Asia-Pacific Civil-Military Center for Excellence. I want to begin by talking about something that happened around 2,800 years ago on the western edge of the Iranian plateau, near Sagres in the Zagros Mountains. Then, we're going to take a virtual detour via the theory of counterinsurgency and state-building, and then travel by way of the Horn of Africa in the 1990s to the far eastern side of that same great Iranian plateau around Kandahar in Afghanistan in 2009. Herodotus's account of Daokis. Herodotus of Halicarnassus, writing in the 5th century BC, gave an account of Daokis, whom he identifies as the first king of the Medes. Here's Herodotus. There was a certain Mede named Daokis, son of Phraortes, a man of much wisdom, who had conceived the desire of obtaining to himself the sovereign power. In furtherance of his ambition, therefore, he formed and carried into execution the following scheme. As the Medes at that time dwelt in scattered villages without any central authority, and lawlessness, in consequence, prevailed throughout the land, Daokis, who was already a man of mark in his own village, applied himself with greater zeal and earnestness than ever before to the practice of justice among his fellows. It was his conviction that justice and injustice are engaged in perpetual war with one another. He therefore began his course of conduct, and presently the men of his village, observing his integrity, chose him to be the arbiter of all their disputes. Bent on obtaining the sovereign power, he showed himself an honest and an upright judge, and by these means gained such credit with his fellow citizens as to attract the attention of those who lived in the surrounding villages. They had long been suffering from unjust and oppressive judgments, so that, when they heard of the singular uprightness of Daokis and of the equity of his decisions, they joyfully had recourse to him in the various quarrels and suits that arose, until at last they came to put confidence in no one else. Histories 1.96. Now, what Herodotus is describing here is a member of a local elite, a man of mark in his own village, using the delivery of justice, dispute resolution, mediation, settling of disputes among the community, as a means to acquire local legitimacy and political power from the bottom up in a traditional society, one where people live in scattered villages without any central authority. Herodotus goes on. The number of complaints brought before him continually increasing, as people learnt more and more the fairness of his judgments, Daokis, feeling himself now all-important, announced that he did not intend any longer to hear cases. Hereupon, robbery and lawlessness broke out afresh, and prevailed through the country even more than heretofore, wherefore the Medes assembled from all quarters, and held a consultation on the state of affairs. The speakers, as I think, were chiefly friends of Daokis. A snide little aside here from Herodotus. We cannot possibly, they said, go on living in this country if things continue as they now are. Let us therefore set a king over us, that so the land may be well governed, and we ourselves may be able to attend to our own affairs, and not be forced to quit our country on account of anarchy. The assembly was persuaded by these arguments, and resolved to appoint a king. 1.97. So Daokis is now starting to successfully transition from local justice to bottom-up state formation, translating the social good and community service of dispute resolution, mediation, and order into popular support, and thence into the formal authority, the rule of law, and the political structure of a state, in this case, a monarchy founded on law. Herodotus again. It followed to determine who should be chosen to the office. When this debate began, the claims of Deioces and his praises were at once in every mouth, so that presently all agreed that he should be king. Thus Deioces collected the Medes into a nation, and he ruled over them alone. 1.98, 1.101. Now, we should say that classicists, archaeologists, and historians don't all agree about this fellow Deioces. He may be the same person as Deyuku, a leader mentioned in the ancient Assyrian cuneiform records during the reign of Sargon II in the middle of the 8th century BC as governing a province in Menea along today's Iran-Iraq border. Interestingly, Diyako, meaning Deioces, is still a relatively common boy's name among Kurds in the same part of Iran. But what we can say, and we'll come back to this, is that Herodotus seems to be tapping into a long-standing trend here, one that links the origins of insurgency warfare with the origins of government. Local non-state actors gaining influence through the local exercise of law and order, especially dispute resolution and mediation, and then translating that influence into formal political authority through processes of state formation from the bottom up. Counterinsurgency theory, a detour. Now, I warned you we'd be taking a detour into counterinsurgency theory, but I also promised to make it as brief and painless as possible. Bernard Fall, a French counterinsurgency theorist of the 1950s and 1960s, wrote in 1965 that a government that is losing to an insurgency isn't being outfought, it's being outgoverned. This is one of the neater expressions of an insight that is fundamental to classical counterinsurgency theory, namely, that insurgents challenge the state by making it impossible for the government to perform its functions, or by usurping those functions, most commonly, local-level political legitimacy, the rule of law, monopoly on the use of force, taxation, control of movement, and regulation of the economy. Robert S. Thompson and David Galula, two leading classical theorists, described counterinsurgency as a competition for government, with both the state and the insurgent trying to mobilize and control the population. Here's Fall. The communists, or shall we say any sound revolutionary warfare operator, the French underground, the Norwegian underground, or any other European anti-Nazi underground, most of the time used small war tactics, not to destroy the German army, of which they were thoroughly incapable, but to establish a competitive system of control over the population. Fall fought in the French resistance in World War II, and later in French Indochina, and was killed in February 1967 in South Vietnam while working as a counterinsurgency researcher. About 20 years after Fall was killed, Joel Migdal, in his book Strong Societies and Weak States, State-Society Relations and State Capabilities in the Third World, 1988, took a deeper look at the functioning of states in society. Now, if you accept the basic Fall-Galula-Thompson insight that counterinsurgency is a competition for governance between a state and an armed non-state challenger, then it becomes really important, in actually running a counterinsurgency campaign, to compare the strength and effectiveness of the insurgents with those of the government they're fighting. But that's really hard if you think in structural terms, because governments are structurally very different from insurgent movements. Governments have fixed locations, a capital, provincial and district offices, a bureaucracy and public service, armed forces and police, and so on, whereas the insurgents may have only a shifting, shadowy network of cadres, fighters, sympathizers, and supporters. They're usually smaller than governments, and it's often difficult to pin down exactly how many fighters they can put in the field at any one time. So all of that makes it extremely hard to compare relative strength and effectiveness. Migdal solved this problem for us by taking a functional rather than structural approach. He identified four functions of government. It has to penetrate society, regulate social relationships, extract resources, and apply those resources to identified group ends. These functions are relevant to any form of governance, including non-state governance systems like tribes or clans, and of course these functions are independent of structure. The beauty of this approach is that the same four functions are exactly what insurgents also have to do if they want to establish the competitive system of control that Fall talks about. And although their structure differs greatly from the government's, Migdal's approach makes it much easier to compare the two, as apples with apples. Jump forward about another 20 years, and Stathis Kalivas, in his book The Logic of Violence in Civil War, 2006, examines the same phenomenon from the standpoint of the third actor in the insurgency triad, the local non-combatant population. Using an exhaustive series of fieldwork studies from numerous conflicts, he shows that one of our common assumptions, namely that insurgent movements are strongest in areas where people support the insurgent's ideology, while governments are strongest in areas where people have a positive view of the state, actually reverses the causality of what really happens. The insurgents aren't strongest where people support them, rather people support them where they are strongest. Likewise, people support the government in areas where government presence is strongest. In other words, support follows strength, not vice versa. Obviously, this finding has huge implications for traditional hearts and minds and battle of ideas approaches, in which you try to make people like you in order to gain their support. Kalivas shows that that's not how it works at all. He taps into the same thing Herodotus is talking about, the fear of disorder and anarchy, and shows that local populations in an insurgency are in a lethally uncertain environment, buffeted on all sides by armed groups who want their support and will kill or punish them if they don't get it. Community leaders are forced to cooperate with the strongest local group and to switch sides as needed as a means to survival. As an aside here, and we'll talk about Afghanistan in more detail in a minute, when I read Kalivas, it reminds me of conversations I've had with Afghan tribal elders and community leaders over the years. Once, last year, I was with a local leader and 11 of his district elders. This guy had fought with the Taliban and had just defected to the government side a few weeks before, and we were all sitting down and talking about the situation, and I asked him what made him decide to leave the Taliban and join the government, and he said, "Oh, you don't get it. I wasn't with the Taliban before, and I'm not with the government now. I was always just trying to protect my people, to look after them. Before, I thought we were better off with the Taliban. Now we think we're better off with the government. But that could change." So this is a classic swing voter approach. Other people take a hedging approach. In both Pakistan and Afghanistan, I've talked to Pashtun leaders from tribes where most families have one son fighting with the Taliban and one with the government, just to cover all bases. Now, Kalivas unpacks the motivation that drives people to behave like this, and his work shows that people will do almost anything, and support almost anyone, to reduce that feeling of fear and uncertainty by establishing a permanent presence, through a predictable system of rules and sanctions that allow people to find safety by compliance with a set of guidelines. Even if those guidelines are harsh and oppressive, if people know they can be safe by following a certain set of rules, they will flock to the side that provides the most consistent and predictable set of rules. Obviously, people don't want to be oppressed, and they want to be treated kindly and have a prosperous life. But as Kalivas shows, these are actually secondary considerations. What people most want is security, through order and predictability, and they will kill to get it. We could describe what we're talking about here as a theory of normative systems, or following Fall's usage, we might talk about systems of competitive control. If you add into the mix Migdal's functionalist state in society approach and Kalivas's insight that support follows strength, and throw in, for good measure, Mao Zedong's observation that political power grows out of the barrel of a gun, then we come to a pretty good understanding of what it takes to prevail in an insurgency, something that I call the theory of competitive control. The theory of competitive control. Simply put, this is as follows. In irregular conflicts, that is, conflicts in which at least one warring party is a non-state armed actor, the local armed actor that a given population perceives as most able to establish a normative system for resilient, full-spectrum control over violence, economic activity, and human security is most likely to prevail within that population's residential area. In other words, whoever does better at establishing a resilient system of control that gives people order and a sense of security where they sleep is likely to gain their support and ultimately win the competition for government. The expression resilient full-spectrum control is important here. Let me explain it by talking a bit about Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Just like any other insurgent or terrorist group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq tried to gain control by manipulating and controlling Iraq's Sunni population, whom they saw as their power base. They did that through a system of rules and sanctions based on a particularly severe and decontextualized form of Sharia that was alien to the population. It included rules like, if you smoke, we'll cut your fingers off. If you're a woman and you push your headscarf back behind your hairline, we'll throw acid in your face. If you fail to give us your daughter in marriage, we'll cut your head off. If we think you're a spy, we'll skin you alive in public. If you're a tribal leader who refuses to cooperate with us, we'll bake your 7-year-old son alive in an oven. All these things actually happened in Iraq in 2006 to 2007, and in fact, I've left out some of the worst things Al-Qaeda in Iraq did. But the point, as I think you'll agree, is that Al-Qaeda in Iraq had a system of control based almost entirely on intimidation. They terrorized people, and they had control in areas where they could maintain that pall of fear over the population, and, as Kalivas would have predicted, where there was a threat to the Sunni community from Shia death squads, people even supported Al-Qaeda in Iraq out of fear that, horrific though they were, the alternative of chaos and oblivion was worse. But the control they established was in a very narrow band, pure intimidation. They were a toggle switch. They could, one, cut your head off, or two, not cut your head off. Beyond that, they were basically incapable, and that made their control very brittle. When we finally succeeded in breaking their reign of terror and lifting the pall of fear off the community, people turned on them in a flash, and they were destroyed. Now, contrast this with an organization like Hezbollah, which has a much more resilient, full-spectrum system of control. Sure, they have a terrorist wing, and they will kill you if you step out of line, but they also have a community militia that will protect you and keep crime down, and they have charities that will help you if you are poor, and they can get you a job, and teach your children in their schools, and treat you in their hospital if you are sick, and represent you in parliament through their political party, and you can watch their television channel, Al-Manar, and listen to their radio station and read their newspaper. Al-Qaeda were thugs. Hezbollah and groups like them, including Jaish al-Mahdi, Muqtada al-Sadr's Shia movement in Iraq, are much, much more than that. In fact, they are acting very much like a government, which is, after all, another normative system based on wide-spectrum systems of control. So Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Hezbollah are at opposite ends of a spectrum here, and as we'll see in a minute, the Taliban are somewhere in between, but far closer to Hezbollah in their approach than to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. But speaking of normative systems, clearly the rule of law is the ultimate normative system of control. It lays down rules, associates each rule with a sanction if you break the rule, sets up a system of published laws that aid predictability and consistency, and establishes a judiciary, In democracies, an independent judiciary, a police force, prisons, lawyers, judges, etc., all in the interests of making people feel safe and secure through a standardized and ordered normative system. And this is a huge factor in social stability that ultimately becomes the basis for government. Rule of law in this sense, as Herodotus clearly knew, is literally the foundation of both the state and of social order. Now, if Noam Chomsky or some of my other predecessors in giving this lecture were here, this would be a great opportunity for them to interject and say, "Aha, you've admitted it. Government is just another oppressive protection racket, no better or worse than rebels, insurgents, or so-called terrorists. In conducting counterinsurgency, you're no better than the enemy, and you're engaging in a fundamentally illiberal and oppressive activity, because you're trying to establish a system of control just like them. States, with their police and courts and armies and parliaments, are just like insurgents, except that they own the means of legitimacy." Well, I think that drawing any moral equivalence between what some insurgents do, as we've seen, beheading people or baking children alive, and what legitimate governments do, like enforcing speeding and taxation regulations and upholding the laws against homicide and robbery, is gravely misplaced. But functionally, as Migdal would have it, there is certainly an equivalence, and this is where rule of law, state building, and the character of the state really come into play. To answer the objection that counterinsurgency is fundamentally immoral and oppressive, though, we need one final bit of theory here, which is the observation that counterinsurgency techniques mirror the state that uses them. Counterinsurgency mirrors the state. An insurgency, according to current U.S. military doctrine, is an organized movement aimed at the overthrow of a constituted government through the use of subversion and armed conflict. Stated another way, an insurgency is an organized, protracted politico-military struggle designed to weaken the control and legitimacy of an established government, occupying power, or other political authority while increasing insurgent control. Counterinsurgency, meanwhile, is just an umbrella term that describes the full range of measures that governments take to defeat insurgencies. These can be political, administrative, military, economic, psychological, or informational, and these are almost always used in combination. There's no standard set of techniques in counterinsurgency. In fact, the precise approach any particular government takes to defeat an insurgency depends very much on the character of that government. Indeed, any given state's approach to counterinsurgency depends on the nature of that state, and the concept of counterinsurgency can mean entirely different things depending on the character of the government involved. And I would submit that this means that good governments can do counterinsurgency badly, but bad governments can't do it well. Oppressive governments tend to enact brutal measures against rebellions, and military dictatorships tend to favor paternalistic or reactionary martial law policies, whereas liberal democratic states tend to be quick, perhaps too quick, to hand control to locally elected civilians in a bid to return to normalcy. You only need compare the approach taken by Syrian President Hafez al-Assad in crushing the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood, at Hama in 1982, or by Saddam Hussein in massacring Kurdish civilians at Halabja in 1989, with British policy in Northern Ireland, or our own policies in Iraq and Afghanistan, to see this. So I think counterinsurgency can be oppressive and inhumane, but it's not inhumane by definition. That depends on the character of the state involved. Okay, we're nearly done with theory, but let's visit the Horn of Africa as promised, and what I want to look at here is the contrast between theory and reality, and more specifically, between top-down versus bottom-up nation-building. Top-down versus bottom-up. Somalia versus Somaliland. It may surprise you to realize this, or not, but in the past it has actually been rare for counterinsurgents to compare notes with peace-building specialists, members of the international development community, and rule of law experts. That's changing, but one of the side effects of that academic stovepiping has been that even though Herodotus was writing about this stuff more than 2,500 years ago, we currently lack a generally recognized theory of opposed nation-building or of bottom-up state formation. Because of this, when the international community becomes involved in reconstruction and stabilization, institutions like the UN, the World Bank, the IMF, and governments tend to focus on top-down, state-centric processes that have a structural focus on putting in place the central, national-level institutions of the state rather than a functional focus on local-level governance functions. Now, empirically, these top-down, state-centric approaches seem to be much less useful than bottom-up, community-centric approaches. Current experience in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Horn of Africa, specifically the different experiences of Somaliland and Somalia, actually suggests that bottom-up, civil society-based programs that focus on peace-building, reconciliation, and the connection of legitimate local non-state governance structures to wider state institutions may have a greater chance of success in conflict and post-conflict environments than traditional top-down programs that focus on building the national-level institutions of the central state. For example, as the anthropologist Johan Lewis has shown, in Somalia since 1992, the international community has engaged in a series of failed attempts at top-down nation-building that have been captured and perverted by local elites, many of whom have been the same warlords who made the problem in the first place. Meanwhile, just to the north in Somaliland, a series of local clan peace deals in 1992 led to district-level agreements in 1993, regional charters, and the formation of provincial and then national government in 1994. This has resulted in a relatively high degree of peace, order, economic recovery, and the rule of law in Somaliland, and to some extent in Puntland, despite lack of international recognition and involvement. In fact, Somalia is virtually a laboratory test case, with the South acting as a control group against the experiment in the North. We have the same ethnic groups, in some cases the same clans, or even the same people, coming out of the same civil war and the same famine and humanitarian disaster, resulting from the collapse of the same state. Yet you see completely different results arising from a bottom-up peace-building process based on local-level rule of law versus a top-down approach based on putting in place a grand bargain at the elite level. Likewise, in Iraq in 2007, the coalition forces during the surge went in with the intent to create security for Iraqis that would then lead to a national-level peace deal, a grand bargain that would resolve the conflict. Instead, the opposite occurred. A series of local agreements and reconciliation processes created peace and security at the local level, with our security presence acting as a critical enabler, as Khalifas predicted, which resulted in an improvement in security overall, again, bottom-up and civil society-led, not top-down and national government-based. And of course, local agreements that are enforceable are just another form of normative system, sanctioned by society, and upheld in a very similar manner to the rule of law. In fact, police, courts, and a judiciary system, along with local representative councils, were some of the first institutions that these communities found it necessary to create. The Taliban and the rule of law. So, finally, we come to Afghanistan, and here we have seen exactly the same thing. International assistance efforts focused on building police and courts and ministries and institutions at the level of the central state, as well as international aid programs, became bogged down in bureaucracy, duplication, and inefficiency. This breakdown created a vacuum at the local level, which the Taliban filled. They came in at the grassroots level and took over the functions of security, mediation, dispute resolution, and community policing, and they brought the world's most convenient and attractive cash crop, the poppy, to the Afghan farmer. The Taliban thus successfully sidestepped our top-down approach and were able to outgovern the Karzai government at the local level. To paraphrase Bernard Fall, in Afghanistan the government is losing to the Taliban, and it's losing because it's being outgoverned, not outfought. Let me give you some examples. Across the south of Afghanistan today, about 15 Taliban Sharia law courts are operating at the local level. Now, when you hear the term Sharia court, you may think of people having their hands cut off for stealing, women being stoned for adultery, beheadings, and so on. And that does happen. But in fact, the majority of the work of these courts is commercial or civil rather than criminal law. They issue title deeds and resolve land disputes, settle water and grazing disputes, handle inheritances and family law, issue ID cards and even passports in the name of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, and basically deliver a local dispute resolution and mediation service with a reputation for harsh but fair and swift justice. In other words, the courts form part of a resilient, full-spectrum system of control. They are, in fact, doing precisely what Daoki's did, and like him, they are translating local dispute resolution and mediation into local rule of law, and thus into political power. For example, a friend in Kandahar tells me that there's a Taliban court just outside the city that formally subpoenas people to testify in court, and people go, even from within the supposedly coalition-controlled urban area of Kandahar city, because they know they'll be punished if they don't, by local Taliban enforcement squads who act and work a lot like local police. There is, in fact, a silent campaign of intimidation, coercion, and control happening right under our noses. So who's in charge in Kandahar? In some places, local warlords or drug dealers, and in some places, the Taliban, but clearly not the government. In Migdal's terms, the Taliban have penetrated society and are playing a major role in regulating social relationships. They are also extracting resources and applying these resources to identified group ends. Taliban tax assessors, associated with the local Taliban governors whom the Taliban have appointed for each village and district, go out on a regular basis and assess people's property and crops and then levy taxes, usually around 10%, in a firm but generally equitable manner. So the Taliban, at the local level, are acting a lot like a government. How is the actual government doing? Well, the Afghan government levies no taxes, relies largely on corruption and shakedowns of the population, has no functioning local court system, doesn't have a presence at the local level in about two-thirds of the country, and when it does have a presence, its local representatives tend to act so corruptly or oppressively that they alienate the population. And that's even leaving aside the significant loss of legitimacy resulting from an election that a lot of people saw as fraudulent and flawed. In other words, in terms of Migdal's functional approach, the Taliban are the real government of much of Afghanistan. Remember Bernard Fall? We can beat the Taliban in any military engagement, but we're losing in Afghanistan not because we're being outfought, but because the Afghan government is being outgoverned. Unless we take drastic action to counter corruption, prevent abusive and oppressive practices by local officials, especially the police, reform local-level systems, and create legitimate local government structures that can function in the interests of the population, there's little doubt that we are eventually going to lose. Two other things the Taliban have done really demonstrate that they understand the government's weakness in this area and see the importance of the competition for local legitimacy. First, the Taliban have established an ombudsman system, such that if a local Taliban commander does something abusive or wrong, people can go and have their complaint heard by an independent authority, and that Taliban commander will be punished and the people will be compensated. Now, that push for fairness and accountability is a direct challenge to the state. It's saying, The government will exploit you and abuse you. The coalition forces will bomb you, and there's really nothing you can do about it. But we are fair, predictable, and just. Secondly, the Taliban has a code of conduct, known as the Layiha, that reads a lot like a military justice or field service regulation. We first saw this back in 2006, and in May 2009 we captured an updated, expanded version of it. This is a set of rules, guidelines for behavior, and admonitions to treat the population fairly, and a set of legal authorities that lays out how Taliban groups are to operate. This is a code of conduct that the local people know about, and combined with the ombudsman system and the Taliban court system, it means that there is a high degree of accountability here. Now, don't get me wrong. The Taliban are oppressive and intimidatory as well. They will put a gun to your head and force you to comply. But then a lot of local-level officials and drug dealers and warlords and other people associated with the government are oppressive and intimidatory as well. And this is a competition. You don't have to be perfect, but you do have to do better than the other side. Some conclusions. Let me start drawing together some of the threads we've been talking about. Herodotus's account of Deioces is something of an archetype, a semi-mythical description of how rule of law, the delivery of justice, and the establishment of locally legitimate presence becomes the foundation not only of social order, but of the state itself. As Fall, Galula, and Thompson have shown, counterinsurgency is a competition for government, and as Migdal and Calivas have shown, you win that competition by penetrating society, regulating people's actions through a normative system of rules and sanctions that create predictability and order, and establishing a presence that causes people to feel safe and makes them flock to your side. You can get things right at the level of counterinsurgency technique, but if the state is fundamentally oppressive, corrupt, or illegitimate, that won't help you. As I have said, this is a competition for control, and the side that best establishes a resilient, full-spectrum system of control that can affect security, rule of law, and economic activity at the local level is most likely to prevail. And as our current experience in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia shows, in places where local people have taken a bottom-up, peace-building approach based on local peace deals, enforceable agreements among local groups, and normative systems that protect the community from threats and disorders, the results have been far better than in places where the international community has taken a top-down approach, focusing on the institutions of the central state. Yet that top-down approach does seem to be the international community's default setting in these types of situations. To conclude, let me give you three implications that I think arise from all of this. First, counterinsurgency and counterterrorism people need to start talking more with the peace-building and development community, and they both need to talk much more with the rule of law community. These academic and policy communities have been intellectually segregated for far too long, and the more we share insights, the better we'll do in the field. We need to look at our theories of top-down state building and recognize what empirical evidence from the field is telling us, that bottom-up, community-based, civil society approaches are having much greater success than top-down, state-based approaches. This doesn't mean we can do without top-down structures, but it does mean we need to put a lot more effort into bottom-up issues, especially rule of law. Second, in terms of Afghanistan, all of this suggests that we need to give top priority to anti-corruption action, governance reform, creating a functioning government at the local level, and establishing sufficient presence to make people feel safe. Until now, we have had policies that basically focused on fighting the main force Taliban and extending the reach of the Afghan government. But as we've seen, it's not the main guerrilla units that are the problem. It's that the Taliban is outgoverning the Afghan government. And if our strategy is to extend the reach of a government that is corrupt, is oppressing its people, and is failing them, then the better we do at that strategy, the worse things are going to get. Finally, we need to recognize that we're facing a crisis of legitimacy here, founded on a failure to connect at the local level with ordinary Afghans. Our efforts have been captured by an elite, the same warlords the Taliban overthrew in 1996, and the elite is doing what elites do, acting in an extractive and exploitative way toward its population. The election result has just underlined that fact and made visible to the international community something that lots of Afghans have known all along. I don't think the war is lost, and I don't think the situation is hopeless. The additional troops, resources, civilian specialists, and money, as well as the better leadership that the international community is putting into Afghanistan, will create a window of opportunity. But I do think we have to urgently seize that opportunity and use it to focus on fixing what's wrong at the local level of the Afghan government, or that window will close again, and it will all be for naught, and the cost to the Afghan people will be immense. We can still turn this around, but we have to act now, and we have to focus on governance, rule of law, anti-corruption action, and protecting the people at the local level. It's not rocket science, and these are hardly original ideas, but translating them into action is really, really hard, and we need to get on it.